Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we are beginning with the massive protests in Chile. On October 25th, 1 million Chileans took to the streets to protest the state repression and backbreaking neoliberal economic policies of President Sebastián Piñera's government. The protests were initially sparked by the government's plan to increase subway fares by 3%. They were later reversed. But the fare hikes was the last nail in the coffin for millions of Chileans who say they are done with neoliberalism, inequality, and police repression. 1% of the Chilean population holds 33% of the wealth in that country, making it the most unequal country and the OECD group of nations. In spite of a brutal crackdown by Chilean military forces, protesters of all ages have vowed to stay on the streets until their demands are met. According to Chile's Human Rights Institute, 18 people have died in the violence, 2,000 have been injured, 38 with gunshot injuries. Over 45 people have been arrested, most have been released within 24 hours, and police officers have been accused of beating and sexually abusing protesters. A few weeks ago, today's guest, journalist Jonathan Franklin, was covering a protest in Santiago as armed men in masks fired at protesters defying a curfew under martial law. Jonathan Franklin is an investigative journalist for The Guardian based in Santiago, and you can find one of his latest pieces called Chile Protesters. We are subjugated by the rich. It's time for that to end. He spoke with seven people about why they are taking to the streets and what they are fighting for. Hi, Jonathan. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. About to have another huge protest in Chile today. People are already starting to gather.
Oh, wow. So this is day 20, right?
I'm not the one to ask. I think it's okay. Like day 19. I haven't slept.
Yeah, I'm sure. So just give us the latest. You have been writing really incredible stories about what's been happening on the ground. There's video when you were out on the streets and masked men fired at protesters. Just tell us, what is happening now?
What's happening now is that the government keeps making worse and worse decisions. You know, there's been this sense that when the crisis hit, President Piñera was invisible. As it got worse, he declared war on his own population and brought in the military. There's just a real disconnect between the government from the highest levels, meaning, you know, the president and the cabinet, down to even the socialist and the progressive parties. There's pretty much no politician or political group in Chile that's harvested any goodwill or support from this. It's as if the Chilean political class, all of it, is pretty much irrelevant from the day-to-day life of the Chilean people. The only exception, I would say, is the mayors. You know, the mayors are kind of becoming a political force for stability and for reform. But it's just remarkable the way in which the Chilean people have decided that, you know, the institutions that everybody thought Chile was so stable in and such an example of have been thrown out the window.
Well, let's talk about how that happened, and then we'll talk about what you're hearing from people on the streets. First of all, tell us about the president, Sebastián Piñera. He is a billionaire. According to Forbes, he and his family are worth $2.8 billion. Where does their money come from?
Okay, Sebastián Piñera is a self-made man. He's, I think, number 804 in the world, most richest, you know, a kind of guy who made his money, most of it in the stock market, or kind of not quite venture capital, but investing in publicly traded companies and banks and airlines, you know, known to work 20 hours a day, amazing problem solver, but has a huge blind spot, which is that he really does not understand the nation he's supposed to be governing. I think that time and time again, we've just seen this complete disconnect between what the presidential palace is observing, what the rest of the world is living. So his approval rating is now down to 9%, and there's a huge push to have him resign. I mean, the entire capital is spray painted with calls for him to resign.
How long has he been in power?
Just a couple of years, like 2 years. It's his second term. He was in Chile. You can't get reelected consecutively. So he was president for 4 years. Then he was out for 4 years. Now he's about halfway through, and it's just been a complete disaster.
And then what about the rest of the government? You were talking about how politicians in Chile are completely out of touch with the people. How does the government work? What else can you tell us about that?
Well, what we're seeing here is, you know, Chile's got very progressive socialist, communist party, a couple socialist parties, and then a very right-wing party. But what we're seeing is that in Congress, the left is, spending half their time filing lawsuits and constitutional accusations against the right, and the right is trying to push through, you know, more laws to protect the police during protests. Even the human rights groups are arguing among themselves over, who's right and who's wrong. I was at a human rights press conference just 2 days ago, and I walked out and just discussed that, you know, they weren't talking about the victims. I mean, there's just way too much ego and way too much kind of procedure, and the people are not waiting for it. It's kind of, they're not going to wait, and they're not going to burn Chile to the ground. But this, I believe, is an insurrection. This is not a crisis. This is not, a march. There's a wholesale insurrection in Chile right now, which is shocking to pretty much everybody who lives here. Very few of us thought that a march could have 1.2 million people in Santiago plus another 300,000. To put that in perspective, that would be the same in the United States, you know, adjusted for population, of 30 to 35 million people marching on the same day.
Wow, because Chile's population is about 18 million.
Yeah, 16, 18, and, you know, so it's, you know, it was about 10% of the country on the streets. So the states, imagine 35 million people marching in the streets of the United States.
I can dream about that. Wow. So a population of 18 million people and 1.2 million are on the streets of Santiago. One more question about the politicians. So if the president of Chile is in the 1%, and again, the 1%, 1% of Chile's population holds 33% of the wealth in the country. What about the other population, the politicians? Are they also wealthy? Are any of them average people?
Well, the salary they get in Chile is pretty outrageous. I think their month, and I'm just doing back of the envelope calculations from Chilean pesos to dollars, but their average monthly salary is about $12,000, and they also have about another $25,000 to $30,000 in spending. So all your congressmen and senators have about $40,000 a month to work with, which is just, you know, in a country where the average person is making $600, so they're getting $40,000. So it's just outrageous.
Wow, how did that happen?
I don't know that. I don't know the history of it. There's been some move by some of the younger congressmen who were student leaders who were elected to Congress. They've been trying to cut it in half, but that hasn't been so popular among their colleagues.
Wow. So talk a little bit about how Chile got to the point where 1% of the population holds 33% of the wealth.
Well, Chile's a tiny nation in the sense that the Santiago is, 5-6 million people. So you have all the political power and all the commercial power is in one city. It's very centralized. It's kind of the classic 10 or 20 families of Latin America who own all the banks, who own all the supermarkets. And it's a really funny economy because it's always held up as this free market Chicago boys, you know, perfect, let the rules of the free market rule. But actually, it's a complete cartel. You know, there's a few people who run the economy. There's been massive cases of price fixing, you know, and everything from frozen chickens to the supermarkets to the pharmacies. And what we're seeing now is the industries that are most hated by the public are the ones that are getting looted and burned. That would start with the metro, which is a subway, because the fares went up. The electric company, because there was two 10% increases in the electrical fares. The private pension funds, which took huge commissions of people's savings and supposedly administered their pension funds to not very good results. The pharmacies, which charge a fortune. I mean, I would say, you know, drug prices here are like twice as much as there in the U.S.
Wow.
So these are all getting looted and burned and destroyed by the hundreds. And we're really just kind of seeing a rebellion against this very unfair economy. For example, if you get if you don't pay the toll on the highway, let's say it's $10, you don't pay it, they can charge you 40 times that. So you know people who don't pay four or five tickets at $50 could be facing thousands and thousands of dollars of fines. interest rates on credit cards can hit 40%. You know, it's just completely abusive, and people are just sick of it.
Today we are speaking with Jonathan Franklin, who's on the ground in Santiago. He has been covering the mass protests there for The Guardian. And if you have any questions for Jonathan about what's happening on the ground, he'll be with us for about 15 more minutes. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Jonathan, you had a great piece recently where you spoke with seven protesters. And one young woman said, "We are subjugated by the rich. It's time for that to end." You spoke with a 60-year-old school teacher, a 25-year-old makeup artist, a 25-year-old filmmaker, an 18-year-old student, an art history student. So a wide range of people. What are you hearing from people on the streets? What are their main demands?
The main demands are a new constitution. The constitution under which Chile is governed now came into play in a very fraudulent process in 1980 when General Pinochet, the army commander-in-chief, was in charge, and it was pretty much stuffed down their throat. And it has all sorts of prohibitions on changing laws, like you might need two-thirds or three-quarters to change a law. So it basically allows a hardcore right-wing minority of, say, 20 or 25% to block any reforms. So it looks like it's democratic, but a solid with one quarter, you know, hard right wing, you can basically stop all the reforms. So it's something I've never seen before in 25 years of reporting. But you have all these students and older people, and everybody's talking constitutional law. It's kind of funny. They have these things called cabildos, which are kind of like public town meetings, and you have all these like high school students sitting around like arguing constitutional law. And I was out at night during the curfew, and people were setting up barricades, and you know, you ask them why they were building the barricades and risking getting shot, and they went into this big discussion of constitutional this and constitutional that. So there's a whole huge, huge effort to kind of reinvent representative democracy. And the right wing brings up the specter of Venezuela. Every time the Chileans talk about a new constitution, the right wing starts screaming, "Oh, you just want another Venezuela." So it's the conversation gets mired in politics immediately and ideology, but there's a huge, huge grassroots swell which is going to lead to a new constitution, whether the government agrees or is dragged kicking and screaming. That I'm almost sure that will happen, and they will have a plebiscite, and there will be all sorts of mechanisms by which that will be developed. But it's a very, very interesting experiment here that we're seeing. And the people are, you know, the makeup artist, she's 25, who I interviewed, and she said, you know, "I'm fighting because my mom fought for me and my grandmother fought for her. I have a 6-year-old daughter. If I fight now, in 20 years, things will be better for her, and maybe she won't have to fight." And then she said, you know, "What I don't want to do is turn 50 and look back and say, damn, you know, I wasn't courageous enough to fight."
Wow. Wow. And then you also spoke with a 60-year-old school teacher who said, "I'm not afraid. I have nothing to lose. I'm doing this for my granddaughter, who is 6 months old."
Yeah, there's a real sense of generational responsibility here. I mean, as we speak, I'm in the studio of an amazing young Chilean band called Fletcher, and they you know, they're talking about a new protest video and song that they released yesterday. It's called, you know, Atentamente Los Chilenos, like you know, attention Chileans. And this video, it's just gone completely crazy. I think it's got 600,000 reproductions in the first day. And when I asked them, you know, why they're doing this, they just said, you know, there's two Chiles. There's the 1%, and there's the rest of us. You know, our city plazas are ugly. Our streets are full of holes. The guy, the bassist for the band, just told me that his grandfather has cancer, and you know, they went to the public clinic and they waited 8 or 9 hours, only to be told, "Come back in 2 weeks." And this is for somebody who's got very, very serious cancer, whereas I personally, you know, I'm a journalist, I make decent money, I can go to a clinic and get probably, you know, in an hour see somebody. I mean, it's just outrageous the differences between what most Chileans have to live with and what a small minority, myself included, are able to access. I was speaking to a former minister today, and he said, Jonathan, you and I, where we live, there's hundreds of public services. Where the rest of Chile lives, there's 10 services. You know, they barely have a bus stop. They barely have the schools have 30, 40, 50 kids in a class. You know, my own daughters were in public school for years, and, you know, the little things, but like gym class is held on a cement tile floor. You know, you're running around playing soccer on cement tiles, and you fall, you break your head. I mean, it's these little things that add up. And when you ask people, you know, they say our salaries only get to the 15th or 16th of the month. So we have credit cards, not to buy luxuries. We have credit cards to buy food.
Well, you also spoke to a 25-year-old filmmaker who said, the people are tired of being treated like slaves or criminals. If you don't have an important last name or don't have money, you are nothing. The other thing that struck me is another young person told you that social media is really changing things. They're just not willing to put up with the status quo, you know, that maybe past generations have put up with, because there's communication happening around the world now. People are in touch. You're able to organize online. The you know, protesters in Chile are seeing what's happening in Hong Kong and Iraq and Lebanon. I mean, it's really an amazing time right now.
Yeah, it's interesting that for sure the social media has allowed the protesters to be far more nimble. And even more importantly, social media allows for instant problem solving. And there's this real gap between the way in which a government, not just the Chilean government, but a government can resolve citizens' demands and the way we as citizens can. If there was a earthquake in Chile right now and they didn't lose, you know, the phone service, it's going to be citizens who are going to be, you know, organizing food drives, citizens organizing, you know, fire brigades, citizens coordinating caravans. The government's going to be looking for the requisition form to fill up a truck with gasoline, and the citizens are going to have 50 people in a group, and we're going to be saving lives. So it's structurally, it's almost like we have analog governments and a digitalized citizenry.
Wow. You know, Jonathan, you talked about the right wing and the power that they have. What about the left? How healthy and how strong is the left in Chile?
The left wing in Chile has a very strong electoral base, probably 30 to 40% of the country, maybe even 50. But they've been completely discredited in the sense that this is kind of the dream of the Chilean left, an uprising against the neoliberal model, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands on the street. But no political party would dare show their logo or their flag at any of these protests. They'd probably get lynched. It's amazing how there's just a rejection across the political spectrum for whether it's, you know, the left-wing parties have an approval rating of, you know, 14%, nothing. It's like they've been annihilated from the political landscape. It's really remarkable. You would have thought that there would be somebody saved, but except for a guy named Jorge Sharp, the mayor of Valparaiso, and a couple of the young student leaders who have come to power and are members of Congress now, there's really the organized left thus far has had almost no influence or ability to harvest from this.
What do you think explains that?
There's a saying in English, I think they were talking about Republicans and Democrats, you know, they all eat at the same table. In a certain way, I think there's this sense that the political class making their, you know, 40 grand a month, you know, 12 grand salary and another, you know, 25, 30 grand in incidental expenses is just living on a different planet. And there's also a sense that most Chileans don't vote anymore. So to become president of Chile, you need 3 million votes out of a population of 16, you know. So if 4 out of 5 Chileans ignore you, but 1 out of 5 vote for you, you can be elected president. So I really think that there's going to be a very interesting experiment in democracy here. The Chileans with Salvador Allende tried to look at a new way to divide power, and it ended horribly for all sorts of reasons. But in 2019, the Chileans are going to be very cutting edge in the kind of solutions they look for. And I think there's a lot of examples, and there's a reason that Chile, with only 16, 18 million people, is carries so much weight internationally. And I think it's because they have a history of pushing the envelope in terms of what it means to be a democracy.
Jonathan Franklin is an investigative journalist for The Guardian based in Santiago, where he has been covering the mass protests in Chile. You can find his latest reporting at yourcallradio.org. Jonathan, let's talk about the brutal crackdown on these protesters. Doctors say that they have not seen these kinds of injuries. Enrique Morales Castillo, the president of the Human Rights Department at Chile's Medical College, said he has seen more than 160 eye injuries since the protests started. He said, quote, "The issue of eye loss surpasses any other period in the history of the country and even internationally. No other country has even reported this number of cases." So what explains this level of violence?
Well, I think to be fair, and I spent a lot of time out in the middle of the protest, either on rollerblades or on a bicycle, or just, you know, I really don't believe anything either I see on TV or social media. So I'm actually trying to be there front row. Mm. And I have to say that the police violence has been horrendous, but it's an insurrection. It's not... I've seen police being lynched, you know, getting hit on the head by 2x4s. I've seen police get knocked off their motorcycles with a brick to the head, and then people stomping the police on the ground. So I think it's incorrect to really focus just on the violence by police. I think really what we're seeing here, and I've talked to a lot of people, is that the Chilean government is unable, or the administration is unable, to think of a better solution to solving this problem than sending out these guys to just beat the crap out of people. So I think the police are in kind of a no-win situation, and that most of these police guys are getting paid terrible salaries. They live in the same neighborhood as the protesters, and they're just, you know, being sent out there thinking that, you know, if you beat enough heads, then it's going to stop. And what the government didn't realize is that this younger generation of Chileans is not afraid of the military. The government brought thousands of young troops to the streets, and instead of running away scared, the Chileans stood in their face and screamed at them. They spat in their face. They defied them. I walked into the supermarket with my own, I was a 22 or 23-year-old daughter, and the policeman said, "Are you together?" And she looked at him and said, "Yeah, well, what about it?" You know, just there's a real sense that the military have no role in domestic law enforcement, and the Chileans have been really clear about that. And what happened is that the government, and a lot of their security apparatus was right wing, thought they could just, you know, bash enough heads and stop it. And of course, bashing all these heads just, you know, ratcheted the violence up. And I'd say now you have probably about 1,500 civilians injured, but also about 800 police injured. I mean, there's hundreds of Molotov cocktails being thrown left, right, and center, and not to be trite, but there's no tradition of baseball in Chile. So the dude throws a Molotov and it goes behind him and hits, you know, some old lady in the head. I mean, they can't throw a baseball 10 foot, never mind a Molotov. So people, I mean, innocent people are getting whacked by the protesters all the time, and I think that it's unfortunately a natural consequence of an insurrection that people are dying and people are getting shot. And I think the police have been extremely violent, and I think that the protesters have been extremely violent, and I think that that's the real ugly side of this. But I think all the protesters I've spoken to said, you know, we marched peacefully for years, nobody paid attention. We started burning down the city, you know, we got results. And for all these people who love to talk about Chile being this, you know, perfect textbook economy, you could actually argue that this is textbook economics. You know, you burn $300 million worth of infrastructure to get the government to invest $2 billion. And most Wall Street people would say, wow, you know, $300 million to get $2 billion, you know, that's a good investment. And I'm not being trite about all the stores are being burned down and the businesses that are lost, and tens of thousands of jobs have been lost already. But it kind of took something really really extreme in terms of an insurrection of this level. It's all across the country, you know, from Antarctica to the Atacama Desert. This is happening all throughout Chile. And it really took a hardcore insurrection with the corresponding violence and you know, shutting down the system to get the government's attention. And the government, to their huge regret, I would say even now, you know, send in the troops to try and beat everybody up, and just made it much worse.
So, as you said, 1,500 people have been injured. At this point, is it 18 people have died in the violence?
Yep. Yeah, and about half the people have been shot or beaten to death, and probably the other half have probably been burned to death inside places where they were looting.
What about you? You report that police officers have been accused of beating and sexually abusing protesters. And the BBC quoted Barbara Sepulveda Hales of a feminist network of lawyers. She said that she and her team are going around to police stations to check on detainees. And she said that sexual violence is a big problem. Women are being stripped in front of others. Also rape. She's been seeing torture patterns that are repeated throughout the country. What about that?
Okay. First of all, I definitely don't see torture patterns throughout the country, and that's something I'm looking at pretty carefully. So I do not think this is systematic. I think it's a really gross consequence of just kind of a macho culture. I have four daughters who went through the student revolution. So I often talk to my daughters to ask them, "Hey, when you were in the student revolts 8 years ago, what was the level of sexual, you know, abuse?" And she said, you know, my daughter would say it's very common. They would, you know, make you lift up your skirt, or they try and touch you. And there's all sorts of very weird and disturbing sexual abuse of, and a bunch of the rapes have been of men who have been raped. There's a very, very disturbing undercurrent of sexual violence. And I don't understand where it's coming from. I strongly disagree that it's systematized. I think that, you know, that I think a lot of people are looking for that. And my opinion is you've got kind of a cultural of disgusting tolerance for these kind of behavior, which, because it's widespread in the nation, is also widespread in the most vulnerable situations, i.e., a young woman stuck in a prison cell with a bunch of screwed up cops and degenerate cops around them. So, but I do think it's important to say that, you know, there's massive sexual abuse in Chile in the culture. So I think it's wrong to say that the cops are you know, way different from the other degenerates in Chile, and that we do see lots of sexual abuse here in families, you know, of course, with the church. So it's, I think it's more reflective of a greater society problem than actually perturbation of the behavior of the cops themselves.
Before we let you go, Jonathan, just briefly, what's next? What are you hearing from people on the streets?
Well, it seems like this is going to go on for a long time. The government and the parliament are, you know, like I said, either defending themselves or attacking one another. The left attack the right attack the left. You know, the left is spending all this time filing constitutional accusations against the president. The right is trying to create more protection for police. And so, you know, it's almost like the band on the Titanic. You know, the ship is sinking, and Chile is headed towards more chaos. And I don't see this resolving soon. So, you know, it's very strange. By day, you see all sorts of constitutional conventions. You see all sorts of beautiful debates, music everywhere, culture and art. It's the bicycle revolution. You never saw so many people on bicycles. And then at night, it gets really hairy, and, you know, bands of kids burning down building stores and stuff. So I think it's very unclear how this is going to end up. But I do think the Chileans are searching for a new form of democracy.
Jonathan Franklin is an investigative journalist for The Guardian based in Santiago. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And coming up after a break, we're going to switch gears and talk about Tuesday's elections across the country. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we're going to talk about Tuesday's elections across the United States. In Virginia, Democrats now control the state legislature for the first time in a generation. In Kentucky, Democrat Andy Beshear has claimed victory, but Republican Governor Matt Bevin has refused to concede. These two could not be more different politically. And here in San Francisco, the race for district attorney, which has received national media attention, is still too close to call. We are expecting the next batch of votes today at 4 o'clock. Joining us to discuss coverage is Jeet Heer, a national affairs correspondent for The Nation. Hi, Jeet. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Hi. Great to have you. We're also joined by Tim Redman, founder and journalist of 48 Hills, an online publication that offers breaking news and investigative reporting of San Francisco. Prior to 48 Hills, Tim was the San Francisco Bay Guardian editor and publisher. Hi, Tim. Nice to see you.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. So, Jeet, I want to start off with you. Let's start by talking about the national elections. These off-year elections usually don't get excessive media attention, but because of Donald Trump and next year's presidential election, it got nonstop attention. First off, broadly speaking, what do you think about the coverage the Tuesday's election got? What do you think the media got right and what did they miss?
I think the coverage is, first of all, merited just because there's actually a lot of real interest in these elections. If you actually look at the voter turnout, I think that's very significant. It's like much higher than off-air elections usually are, which indicates a kind of like engaged public. I think one thing is that in the sort of Kentucky race, there's an attempt to say, well, this was not a big Republican loss because it was only the governor and the Republicans won the sort of down ballot races, and so it was just a local issue. But I mean, I think, you know, Donald Trump went to Kentucky, you know, he like very explicitly told people, you know, like to vote Republican for his sake. And it's not just, I mean, even in the races that the Republicans won, they actually got an average of about, you know, 10 points less than they did the last time around. And so I think that there's a, you know, there's been a kind of steady erosion of Republican support. And I don't think we can overemphasize that.
Yeah, and I think also when we look at these elections through the lens of 2020 and through the lens of Donald Trump, I mean, we lose a lot because the change in Virginia is drastic. I mean, it's, when you're talking about reproductive rights, for example, the fact that the Democrats mm-hmm. control the government there is huge, like a complete 180 from the Republicans controlling the legislature there.
That's right, that's right. And I also think like the sort of Democrat-Republican framework misses the sort of energy of progressive movement more broadly, which in some cases, you know, comes from outside the Democratic Party. You know, you had people who were challenging from the left and winning in local races, especially in Pennsylvania. So I think that is a real factor that's out there.
That's right. And there was a piece in the New York Times called Democrats Could Learn a Lot from What Happened in Virginia by Tram Nguyen, a co-executive director of New Virginia Monthly. And it's a piece basically about the people knocking on doors in working class neighborhoods. I mean, this just did not happen overnight. This was a, you know, many, many years of a very strong ground game here.
That's right. Yeah. There has been a lot of building. And it's very interesting. Like in one of the races that they won, it actually went from being an area where they had voted strongly for Trump and now elected at a local level a Democratic Socialist. So I think they really suggest that there's, you know, voters out there that are being brought into the system that weren't before. And I think, again, the turnout is really important. There's been, like, really high turnout across the board. So I think that shows that there's people being politicized who were not previously part of the process.
What about that, Tim, just generally speaking, how the media cover these movements? Because in this piece that was written by Tram Nguyen with New Virginia Majority, Tran wrote that long before Election Day, we registered more than 300,000 voters, knocked on more than 2.5 million doors, and organized within communities of color to help win significant policy changes like Medicaid expansion, which covered nearly 400,000 people.
Yeah, I mean, that is what we're seeing. And, you know, I think one of the unfortunate results of the fact that so many news media outlets are shrinking the number of reporters that they have, thousands and thousands of reporters lost their jobs just last year. Mm-hmm. I think what we see is news media waiting until there's something big. There's an election. There's an election and it changes things. They don't have the bandwidth to go out there and cover these kinds of stories before they happen and let people know kind of the context of what's really happening in communities all around the country.
Right. The other piece that I think deserves more attention when we're talking about Virginia, and I'm reading now from a piece in Salon, Let's see here. In November 2017, a blue wave crashed down upon Virginia as Democrats won the statewide vote by 10 points. So last time around, Democrats won by 10 points, but they did not control the House, which came down to a single race that was resolved by the election board, drawing the Republican's name from a bowl and declaring him the winner. And that's because of gerrymandering. So, you know, a judge ruled that you cannot gerrymander these districts by race, or you cannot gerrymander these districts by party. And so what happens?
Well, they keep trying. I mean, this is, it's a really old political tactic that politicians like to choose their voters rather than having the voters choose the politicians. And if they can draw the districts in this way, and this is actually why it's really important now for Democrats to be winning state houses and governorships, because after the 2020 census, all of these districts are going to be redrawn again. Congressional districts are going to be redrawn all over the country. And if Republicans are in control of state houses, which is where congressional lines are redrawn, then we're going to see a lot more of this.
Right. And what are your thoughts about that? Gerrymandering is finally getting a lot more media coverage.
Yeah, no, I think gerrymandering and the other factor is like the sort of voter rolls, which is also equally important for the Democrats to be controlling the state houses. I think in both Virginia and possibly in Kentucky, there'll be a push forward to re-enfranchise people that were lost their vote through felony conviction. So I think that a broader surge of voting rights is happening, and I think that that will, you know, not only impact like this election, but like elections for the next generation.
Right. And then let's also talk a little bit about voter suppression and what that means, because so many polling places have been shut down in the South since the Voting Rights Act was overturned. And we know that in the last election, I mean, we had on a guest, Carol Anderson, who basically said that Trump would not have won Michigan, Pennsylvania, and
Wisconsin.
Well, thank you, Wisconsin, if it hadn't been for voter suppression. So, Jeet, what are your thoughts about how that's being covered today, voter suppression?
Yeah, you mean in terms of like the media coverage?
Yes.
Yeah. I feel like that is pouring. That's one of the sort of deeper issues that like doesn't get coverage. I think that there's been a lot of activism on the part. I think it's very interesting that after Obama left office, the thing that he's been sort of concentrating his energy on, and Eric Holder's been concentrating their energy on, is sort of legal challenges to voter suppression. I think this is one of the sort of long drawn out fights, but what we're also going to kind of see is if there's a large part of this Republicans who basically think that if they lose an election, then it's illegitimate. And I think we're actually kind of seeing that in Kentucky a little bit. If they lose an election, they'll fight it to the end and maybe also try to take away the power of the governor. So that it's not a real electoral victory,
right.
And I think that's where the fight's going to go next.
Right, and in Kentucky, again, the governor, I'm sorry, the Democrat Andy Beshear has claimed victory in that gubernatorial race, but Republican Governor Matt Bevin has refused to concede. Beshear eked out a win by just about 5,000 votes. And again, Jeet, I think it's so important for the people to point out that these two guys could not be more different when it comes to pensions for teachers, budgets for education, Medicaid expansion, reproductive rights, LGBT rights. You can keep going down the list.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And so there's going to, they'll try to resist the victory as much as they can. And there's certainly, if you have a close election, there's a right to have a sort of recount in many cases. But I think what's more disturbing is the trend towards trying to deny power to Democratic elected officials if they do come to power. And I think we've seen that in other states as well, sort of North Carolina, I think there's a lot of different ways that you can build roadblocks to democracy. And I think we're going to see more and more of that.
Well, Jeet, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be on.
Jeet here is a national affairs correspondent at The Nation, and you can find his writing at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined today by Tim Redmond, founder and journalist at 48 Hills, an online publication offering breaking news and investigative reporting about San Francisco. Tim, before we talk about San Francisco's race, How long have you been a journalist?
Well, my first start in journalism was at the Hartford Courant in Hartford, Connecticut in 1978. And I've been writing about San Francisco since 1982.
Wow.
So a long time. I have the gray hair to prove it.
Well, and I asked him because you have seen so much in terms of just how not only how many media outlets have gone away, mm-hmm. but how many reporters have been laid off. And that results in state houses, various board meetings not being covered.
That's absolutely what happens. It's not only state houses not being covered, board meetings. It's, you know, bringing it to San Francisco for a second. It means that we do not have reporters scrutinizing the claims that are made in elections, particularly these days, all of these hit pieces that we're seeing from independent expenditure committees, mm-hmm. where the money is coming from, who's behind these things. I mean, you know, San Francisco voters get piles and piles of mail, and we've seen ads on TV that that make all kinds of outrageous, inaccurate claims, and there's nobody there to refute them.
Yeah, and I brought in a bunch of the mailers, which we will talk about. Talk about just how important this is, Tim. And I feel like what has happened is so many people are so focused on what's happening in D.C. and not so much in their backyard.
Right, and that again is a result of, in part, a lack of good local reporting. That, you know, the studies all show that whatever you believe in about an issue, if the news media covers something a lot, people think that that is important. Whether they agree or the news media writes a lot about the economy, then people think the economy is important. And that doesn't mean they agree on the solutions. But if local news media do not cover these issues in local elections, then people don't think that's important. They get focused on something someplace else. And then the medium in which the election takes place is TV ads and mailers. That's what people see, and Facebook ads. And those can be wildly inaccurate, and there's no one to correct them.
In a place like San Francisco, this city has more billionaires per capita than any other city in the world. Massive inequality, a massive homeless crisis, which does get national attention. But there's so many reasons why local reporters and reporting is so important in a city like San Francisco.
It's absolutely crucial. The issues facing San Francisco are a microcosm of the issues facing the country, right. Starting with economic inequality. And if we're not looking at, you know, when you look at these campaigns for local races, for mayor, for supervisor, for district attorney, these bring up really important issues that spread across the country. And if we can't bring that home, and, you know, I saw an article in the New York Times, I think last year during the mayor's race, the 2018 mayor's race, basically saying there's no difference between the major candidates. Even the Chronicle has said, oh, you know, everyone's a liberal Democrat in San Francisco. There's no difference. And that is fundamentally untrue. There are major differences between candidates for office and political leaders in San Francisco, particularly around issues like economic equity.
Right. So let's talk about the district attorney's race, because that did get and continues to receive national attention. At this point, we still don't have a winner because it is too close to call. But this district attorney's race is so important because we're talking about how you're going to deal with prosecutions, how you're going to deal with restorative justice. And as Chesa Boudin, a Democratic socialist, pointed out, San Francisco has a 5% African-American population because so many people have been evicted and pushed out. And yet, I'm going to get my stats right, but the population in our jails, do you know it, Tim? The African-American population?
Is overwhelming.
50 to 60%?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The racial element of incarceration is, you know, shows up radically in San Francisco. So does the fact that, you know, 90% of people in San Francisco County Jail have never been convicted of anything. They're there because they can't afford bail. Chesa Boudin and Susie Loftus, the two leading candidates for district attorney, have very different visions for how we should change the criminal justice system and what we should do about it. And I think while there was national media attention because of who Chesa Boudin is, because he is the son of incarcerated parents who were 1960s radicals, I think that's gotten a lot of attention. But there's been less attention, particularly locally, on the issue differences, on how they would operate differently as district attorney. And what that does, of course, if the local news media aren't explaining that, Then it's wide open for groups like the Police Officers Association to put out these misleading mailers and TV ads. You know, I saw a TV ad where it says, you know, Chesa Boudina is going to let murderers and rapists out of jail. And the fact is, he never said that. What he said and what needs to be explained in these races is that he said if the California Board of Prison Terms, the parole board, which, by the way, is not soft on crime. This is a very tough group. If the parole board decides that someone has served enough time and should be released, Chesa Boudin, as San Francisco district attorney, is not going to go in and argue otherwise, which traditionally district attorneys do. They go in and try to argue that parole shouldn't happen. Well, that's not a radical statement at all. That's basically just saying if the people whose job it is to judge whether somebody is a threat to the society say no, that person should be released, all right? The current district attorney's office and district attorney's office all over, they just routinely go in and say, no, keep them in, lock them up. So that's a very different picture than we're going to let murderers out on the streets.
And this is a story because Chesa Boudin got a piece in the Washington Post. He was on Democracy Now, and I have his quote now. It says, "We fill our jails with African-American San Franciscans who make up more than half of the county's inmates, but only 5% of the city's population. We let the wealthy defendants go free on bail, even if they're dangerous, but the poor remain behind bars, even if they're innocent."
Yes, exactly.
That is a story, especially in a city, a so-called progressive city like San Francisco.
It is absolutely a story. And it is a story to look at how the candidates for district attorney would differentiate themselves on addressing that exact issue. And the candidates have differentiated themselves. And, Chesa Boudin is much more interested in alternatives to incarceration and to restorative justice and to ways to resolve, to address the criminal justice system without locking people up. And, you know, Susie Loftus, when she was appointed interim district attorney, one of the first things she did was get rid of one of the existing diversion programs that tries to send people who have DUI convictions, send them to treatment, send them to alcohol treatment, to something other than jail. One of the first things she did was dissolve that program, right, and say, okay, no, the answer to this problem is locking people up. And so I say, there's a difference. That's what the news media need to do, is talk about the actual issue differences between the candidates and explain that. So when the voters go to vote, they'll have an understanding of what they're voting for, as opposed to just seeing the election play out in these hit pieces.
And the hit pieces were pretty ugly. According to the San Francisco Examiner, law enforcement groups, including the San Francisco Police Officers Association, spent more than $654,000 to defeat Chesa Boudin with mailers and TV ads that describe him as dangerous. And I brought in a couple of these ads because I was bombarded. And there's this one. And I have to say, and I wonder what you think, Tim, I feel like there's an underlying racist theme in some of these, because the gang member is going to get you is basically what it says. Now, of course, I'll just put this out there. You can't put a black face on these ads, because I think people would say that's racist. So what they did is they grabbed a white face, a guy with a bandana who's got tattoos on his neck, and that's what they put on the ad.
The racism in the Police Officers Association ads is obvious and clear and, I think, intended. That's what they're doing. They're trying to stir people up and say, there are gang members, which, by the way, is a euphemism for Latino gang members, who are going to come out. I mean, this is just, it's absolutely incredible what's going on. $650,000. But you know what is also incredible, Rose, is that despite all of that, this race is really close. As of today, there's 650 votes separating the candidates. Chesa Boudin won more first place votes than anyone else. And if the votes that they count today break the same way as the votes that they counted tomorrow, this race could be a virtual tie. And we'll know that at 4:00.
Right. And just to let people know, we have ranked choice voting. My vote hasn't been counted yet. A lot of people, you can go onto a website to make sure your vote has been counted. There's 30,000 more votes to count?
There's about 35,000 more votes to count that were election day mail-in votes. And then there's another like 13,000 provisional ballots. And about 1,800 of the provisionals are in District 5. The rest of them are citywide. And those are, for example, we know that some people tried to vote in District 5 and there were no District 5 ballots there. Mm-hmm. Right? So they had to cast provisional ballots. There are people who were supposed to vote by mail, but either their ballot didn't arrive or they didn't fill it out, so they went down to vote and they had to cast a provisional ballot. That always happens. And we don't know how those ballots, where those ballots are from or what way they're going to lean. So we'll know a lot more today at 4 o'clock.
And when do you think we might have a winner? Next week?
Yeah, probably at the rate they're counting now, and they're counting pretty rapidly. And, you know, this is not the fault of ranked choice voting or the elections department. It's the fact that so many San Franciscans vote by mail, right. And so many of them, rather than turning in their ballot when they first get it a month ago, wait until election day to turn it in. And every one of those ballots has to be hand opened. They have to check the signature against it. And that's why these things take so long. I would guess we'll know by Monday or Tuesday.
And quickly, Tim, I want to do a whole show about this. We know that voter turnout is low in an off-season election. But 37% for a city like San Francisco, that's kind of pathetic in my mind.
It's really low. And part of the reason is that there's no contested mayor's race. I mean, right. Everyone knew that London Breed was going to win. So that doesn't bring a lot of people out. And San Francisco continues to do some of these races in off-year elections. And, you know, the logic for that I have heard is, well, if the mayor is running at the same time as the president and the governor, the mayor's race gets lost in the shuffle. So we do it in off-year elections. The problem with that is if you don't have a highly contested mayor's race, and many times in the last 30 years in San Francisco, we have not had highly contested mayor's races, then the turnout gets really, really low.
Mm. I wish it would be amazing to bring this up because these races are so important. We had affordable housing on the ballot. We had sunshine laws, mm-hmm. and that passed.
Yes, it did. But, you know, the affordable housing bond and the tax on Uber and Lyft are still very close. Unfortunately, you need two-thirds vote under Prop 13 for any of these taxes or bond acts. And when you need a two-thirds vote, when you figure that 20 or 25% of the voters are against anything that involves spending money, now you're trying to get two-thirds and you've only got 75% to play. It's very difficult to do when the turnout is low. Mm. Because the other thing is, the conservative voters who never want to spend money always vote.
Mm. Right. Well, hopefully we'll have a winner next week and we will bring you that news. Tim Redmond is founder and journalist at 48 Hills, an online publication focusing on breaking news and investigative reporting in San Francisco. Tim was San Francisco Bay Guardian editor and publisher, and luckily they still put out their election slate. Tim, yes. Thanks for your work.
Of course. Happy to be here.
And thanks for coming in.
Course.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. You can find more information about the show at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, Jonathan Linden, our intern, and David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.